now at McDonald's, a McDouble is only $2.50. So you can get your gym gains on or just get lunch for only $2.50. Get more value on the under $3 menu.
Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher for delivery.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome to this Lotus Eaters interview. I'm Harry, joined today by Dr. Ricardo Duchesne, the author of a number of books on the uniqueness of Western civilization. In fact, his 2011 book was called The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. He is a former professor at the University of New Brunswick and a historical sociologist. Today we're going to be discussing his latest book, Greatness and Ruin, published by Antelope Hill, which traces the self-reflection and universalism of European civilization, its roots, what it produced, and the implications going to the future. Dr. Duchesne, Ricardo, thank you very much for joining us. How are you doing today?
Yes, I'm very pleased talking to you. Lotus, what is it? Lotus Eaters.
Lotus Eaters.
Yes, I heard about it. So I'm very pleased that you asked me to do an interview.
I'm very pleased to get the opportunity to speak about it, because when Antelope Hill sent it, I wasn't familiar with your work. But as you can tell from just looking, you are very thorough in this. You trace a whole number of different artistic and civilizational epochs and revolutions through European civilization. And you make what is sure to be, even among, I would imagine, parts of the conservative right, the more civic nationalist oriented and minded right, a very controversial thesis, the thesis of this book essentially being that Europeans, beginning with the Greeks, but you can trace it back to the Indo-European war bands, made a discovery of the self, the idea that I am me, this abstract I that's separate from the group. This was a unique Western discovery, something that can't really be found in any great measure in any other civilization across the world, including China, who you repeatedly refer to as one of the only real civilizational rivals of Europe going back historically. Many people would presumably find this to be quite a controversial idea, given that we have this inbaked liberalism in the way that we view the whole world right now. The world is not made up of groups, it's not made up of competing tribes, it's all made up of individuals. So it would probably shock a lot of people to hear this idea that the idea of the individual itself was discovered and developed and created, you could almost say, by Europeans. Tell me, when did you first begin to develop this thesis? What led you to embarking down this strain of thought?
Well, when I wrote Uniqueness of Western Civilization, which was published in 2011, if you read it, you can see sections there in which I was already aware that there was something different about Europeans that related to a peculiar tendency to think back into themselves and to try and differentiate that which belongs to the human self and that which is outside. If you read Julian James' work, The Bichimeral Mind. So in that book, he observed that from reading a lot of texts from the ancient world, he observed that at that time, human beings didn't really have a self. It was as if the norms, the traditions, the customs that they inhabited within spoke to them and commanded them to take certain actions and to think in certain ways. And he believed that at some point in the last century BC, you can see emerging an internal voice that belongs to the person thinking and speaking. However, in his view, the Iliad of Homer was still stuck in the past. The characters in the Iliad did not have this inner voice that belongs to them. They did not have an introspective consciousness or a monologue within themselves, but rather were guided by external spirits, norms, gods. Whereas I dispute that argument. I believe that the Iliad is already a transitionary work, and I'm not going to get into the specifics of that. But this idea that I expressed in the first chapter, as I said, I had anticipations of that idea in uniqueness, but I never really made it the central point of the book. Whereas now I start with it, and I argue that this has to be the point around which we begin to distinguish the West from the rest. And it also has to be the point around which we start to understand why it was that the West was far more creative than the other civilizations of the world. I don't accept the argument that it had to do with environmental factors or that it was commerce or trade, a more cosmopolitan view. None of those things explain it for me. So I began in this book to really concentrate on that and try to understand this phenomenon, this unique consciousness among Europeans, starting with the ancient Greeks. There are anticipations there with the prehistorical Indo-Europeans. If you read their poetry and so on, you can see a sense of the I speaking out. In tribal societies, there is no I. You are part of a collective, an expression of that collective. When you see them acting and speaking as groups, you almost see them converging together as if no one stands out. They also look alike very much. They basically have the same thoughts, the same feelings and emotions. And you can see this in our times as well. There have been studies of the crowd. When people come into crowds, they merge into a collective. And people say that even individuals will do things they would never do on their own. But once they're part of that dynamic of the crowd, the screams, the voices they hear, the way everybody's behaving, they just integrate into it. And that primordial collectivism kicks in, even among white people in that atmosphere. And there have been studies of this by psychologists, including Freud. Europeans and whites eventually do develop a very strong sense of their identity, of realizing, philosophers realize this, starting with the pre-Socratics, realizing that there is such a thing as a faculty that is called the mind. It is located in the brain, and it can be distinguished from the other parts of the body. In the past, it may sound strange to us, but human beings did not know where their thinking came from. They thought it was possibly the heart, because the heart is the one thing in your body that is moving and vibrating. And when you get anxious or agitated, it pounds more. And when you scream to people and so on, you know, it moves. So people thought that's where it comes from. The Chinese, up until the Europeans taught them otherwise, they held the view of the heart-mind. The mind was in the heart. They were never able to differentiate the two. Whereas you already see among the pre-Socratic a differentiation of the mind from the other parts of the body. And with Aristotle, in his logic, this is very clear cut. He knows already that human beings, what differentiates them is they have this thinking mind. And then he takes it further and says that the only way that you can arrive at truth, truth claims, and that you can really think about all kinds of questions is by letting your mind make those decisions. So you can see here already the Greeks differentiating themselves from the kinship group and kinship networks, which happens. I mean, the city-state could not have come, could not have been conceived unless the Greeks came up with a concept of civic citizenship. Now, the Greeks at that time were still very ethnocentric. They still saw themselves as a people, a Greek people that were different from the Persians and the Libyans and so on. But nevertheless, they start developing this notion that if you want to belong to a city state, which consists of people from a variety of clans and tribal groups, then you have to get another type of sense of membership of who belongs in that city. It can no longer be, oh, this is my clan, those are my aristocratic leaders, I belong to them, I'm loyal to them, I'm not loyal to Athens. So you can see, and I talk about that, how that happens, that sense of citizenship. So the point I'm making is that not only in the case of Aristotle being able to develop his logic, but also mathematics and philosophical thinking and conceptions of civic citizenship are ultimately rooted in that ability of the Greeks to differentiate the mind and thereby differentiate the I, the thinking self, from everything that is around. Now, in our times, you know, postmodern philosophy and even before that, pragmatism and so on, they dismiss all of that because they say, oh, well, we're always contextualized, we're always overdetermined by a whole range of factors, society, our historical time, and so on. But a point I make is that our very awareness that we are contextualized, that we are surrounded by a whole range of forces and norms that do shape us, is itself an indication that we have an eye and we are aware of those things. In the case of the Chinese and other civilizations, they're not even aware of that. So that's, I would say, is what I felt the eye and the thinking self had to be emphasized right away.
Yeah, and again, I think it's quite difficult for people, again, with this kind of like inbuilt liberalism that we assume by default and project onto the rest of the world, to differentiate what you're really describing there, because everybody recognizes that there are that what you could describe as individual biological beings. You know, there are people who have to sleep and eat and communicate to one another. This is more about the way that they internally conceptualize themselves in relation to the world around them. And I think that's one of the things that makes it quite a difficult thing for many people to wrap their heads around until it's explained to them that this is not something that is even historically the norm up until 200 or 300 years ago for most civilizations outside of Europe. And the thing is that the thesis that you're putting forward does put itself at odds with other ideas that have been put forward for the uniqueness of Western success globally. Like, for instance, you mentioned like environmental factors. People are always trying to pull down European achievements and civilization through citing environmental factors. The most famous thesis regarding this is probably Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel, the idea that the only reason that Africans could never be as successful as Europeans was because the environment around them did not allow for the kind of success that Europe was able to achieve, which examined critically is just absolute nonsense, because Europeans did end up going to Africa and ended up turning it into parts of it into a paradise, like Rhodesia and South Africa were from all accounts beautiful places to live up until Europeans left. But this development of the self and the I, you start to trace it from something like the transitional period of the Iliad going through to Homer's Odyssey. You contrast them against the Epic of Gilgamesh and make the argument the Epic of Gilgamesh is not indicative of this kind of developmental process that you're arguing. But you then talk about, through that, the Axial Age and the contrasting visions of the Axial Age that have been put forward by scholars, and again the way that Western European is attempted to be sort of flatlined with other civilizations by contrasting all of these axial ages against one another and arguing that they're all the same and that Greece and Europe was basically on a similar sort of civilizational trend to Persia and to China and India through that time. Would you like to explain to people with the Axial Age, with, you know, the I think it's 800 BC to 200 BC is the typically accepted time span that's noted. What really sets Greece apart from somewhere like China or somewhere like India? What are the differences in thought that make it make Greece so unique in that time?
Well, the idea of an axial age was postulated by the German philosopher Karl Jaspers. And he did so right after World War II. I think his book on the axial age was published in 1946, maybe 48. So it came right after the Second World War. And it was in reaction to that war. And so Karl Jaspers went back to history. And he said he discovered that around that period between 800 BC, 200 BC, something happened in the old world. There was this dramatic change in the mindset of peoples, in the consciousness of peoples. And he characterized this as the overcoming of all tribalism and the creation of white cosmopolitan civilizations, which came up with some of them, the notion that there is one God. And so they articulated in religious texts ideas that apply to the whole of the civilization, the Persian civilization with Zoroastrianism, the Jews with their Judaism, and then the Chinese, in this case, it was not strictly speaking religious, but it was Confucianism. And so there were a set of ideas within the Confucian text that were articulated as universal ideas that apply to all the Chinese. So that's an overcoming of the parochialism of the tribal past. And so for Karl Jaspers, this signals a universalism, that you see the beginnings of a universalism. The same thing with the Greeks, with Plato and so on. You can see an attempt to articulate universal ideals and norms that apply to the whole of humanity. The other factor that they, Karl Jaspers observed here is there is a reflectiveness. In other words, what we were saying before, that human beings are beginning to kind of step outside the old tribal norm, because all human beings throughout history did inhabit kinship groups. And the way you would think about marriage, about raising your children, what friendship is, how you relate to outsiders, all of that came from that kinship group, the norms that were passed down from generation to generation. So here with the axial age, you see the beginnings of a differentiation of the eye. And I recognize that there is a proto-differentiation of the eye from the prior tribal norms. And they call that reflectiveness. You are reflecting back. You're looking at the world and reflecting about it rather than accepting it as a given. Another element that they observe in the axial age is a kind of historical awareness that this is a time, it's a new time, there was a past, and now we're entering a new world. So the argument I make against this is that, yes, this is true. However, they have exaggerated the degree to which these non-Western societies really became reflective. And secondly, they really underestimate, and I think it's a willful act of underestimation, the degree to which Greece went far ahead of what they saw among the Persians with Zoroastrianism, among the Chinese with Confucianism. In Greece, you don't only have the pre-Socratics, and you have many of them, and they're not saying the same thing, but continuously contesting with each other. So you see already a marked individualism there, that each thinker wants to establish himself as the one that knows, you know, the proper way of thinking about the nature of things. So
Aristotle sets out to differentiate himself from Plato, his teacher, rather than simply just going on to promulgate his teachings over and over and over again and pass them down in that way. There is a continuation, but there's a differentiation as well.
Right, and a development, a sophistication of ideas. I'm not saying that Aristotle is superior to Plato per se, but There is no question that in Aristotle, you will find things that you don't see in Plato. You see someone who is already developing a logic that was never developed by the world anywhere else in the world. There is no formal logic. China, and I have sections on that in my book, has a quasi-logic, but by the standards of what Aristotle achieves, it is a very simple type of logic. You also see geometrical thinking with theorems. And I argue that the only way you can think in those geometrical, theoretical ways is because you are a conscious being that knows that it's not a matter of simply going about doing practical mathematics, but you want to know what is that which underlies this mathematical thinking, and can I find principles by which it is based on or that sustains the deductive reasoning of this mathematics and geometry. But in any case,
one of my favorite ways in which you show the differentiation of Western and European from particularly Chinese thinking is the way in which you discuss, and there's lots of really interesting things in this book like this. You talk about the West conceptualizing paradoxes of the mind versus the Chinese idea of a paradox, which doesn't really seem to exist. For instance, like the liar's paradox, which you state here, that this sentence is false. It's kind of this, it relies on the fact that you are able to see that it logically doesn't make sense as a sentence, whereas the kinds of Chinese or paradoxes that you find in other contexts and cultures around the world don't have that same kind of logical fluidity to them. And in fact, most of them just seem to be false statements that are just passed down from people to people.
Yeah, and the Chinese school of logicians and the ones that detected some, you might call them paradoxes, they were kind of pushed aside by the official Confucians in China as being people that are, you know, making too much of vague sentences. And whereas in the case of the Europeans, they realize that these paradoxes point to very difficult points in the thinking mind, that it reaches certain points at which it just doesn't know where to go. Should it go this way or that way? Because either way doesn't overcome or leads to another contradiction, and doesn't overcome the contradiction. And for Europeans, it was important to find ways to reason through those paradoxes, to find solutions to them, because they wanted to make rational sense of the world, whereas that was not the case with the Chinese.
Yeah, one of the through lines that you can detect through all of this, but with what you just said there as well, is that the kind of restless European mind, you could say the Faustian spirit, is that this finding of problems and then choosing to solve them. And this can be, this can lead to amazing upheavals. This can lead to revolutions that create prosperity and abundance in the world. It can also lead us down the wrong path, as we'll go on to, because if there are no reasonable problems that need to be solved, well, people do start to make up problems. Whereas with other cultures, if they saw those problems, but it wasn't enough of a big problem, who cares?
Yeah. Yeah, that something that I started addressing towards the end of the book. But just to add another point about the Axial Age. So after the pre-Socratics come the classical Greeks, and the classical Greeks, it's not just in philosophy that they make major achievements, but there's a full chapter on this later on. They develop a true historical consciousness but the beginnings of what I might call a proper historical consciousness in writing or inquiring about what happened in the past, and not accepting the hearsay, not simply providing chronicles, that is, a chronology of what the great rulers have done, but simply really inquiring, why did that happen in history? Like Thucydides famously open his the Great Peloponnesian War, he opened it by saying right up front, I want to understand why it was that Athens and Sparta went to war, what the reasons behind it, and I think I have an explanation. And he goes about and offers an explanation. You don't see this in other historical writings. So when I talk about the historical consciousness of Europeans, I'm saying that it is on a high level with the Greeks, even though the Greeks still have a cyclical conception of history, but then they absorb the Christian heritage, which has introduces this linear conception, and they integrate it with the Greek philosophical conception. And by that time, we are moving into Rome. So one of the things that happens and that makes the Christian conception on a far higher level of reflectiveness than what the Hebrew Bible had attained is that the Christian thinkers who are philosophically trained in Greek philosophy and have gone through the experience of Rome, they want to make sense of history as it actually transpired here on this planet. It's not a linear conception that you look to a world beyond the world that you're living now. You're looking for a Messiah. You're looking for a future overcoming of the conflicts that you're living through. No, the Europeans are saying, how do we make sense of the pre-Greek history, Greek history, and the meaning of the Roman Empire? What was it all about? So this is becomes where you start seeing the beginnings of a linear conception. The Romans don't have it yet, but Rome produces many great historians. Tacitus is one, Livy is another one, and many others that I discussed there. So in regards to the Axial Age, I'm trying to argue that the reflectiveness of the Europeans doesn't end in 200 BC. That's just the beginning. And the beginning is already on a higher level than that of any other civilization. Karl Jaspers and subsequent scholars that embraced this idea of an Axial Age were guided, motivated politically by the need to think in terms of a common humanity, because they naively thought, oh, the reason World War II happened is that we have these nationalistic, ethnocentric Europeans, each one thinking they're better than the other. If only we think of a common humanity and we hold hands and embrace each other, we're just going to have a wonderful world. but, you know, you are actually really misinterpreting what happened among the Europeans. And it almost became something you don't do anymore. You cannot, in a classroom, in a Western university, do what I was doing. That is to say to students that something dramatically different happened in Europe, that white people did achieve a lot of greatness. They discovered the world, they accomplished most of the mathematics, the history of painting is far more creative, the history of literature and so on and so on. You can't do that. You have to sort of think in terms of a common humanity, and Confucianism is, you know, is kind of similar, and all of them in their own way. because the reality is they themselves, the Chinese and these other supposedly universal people, remain far more ethnocentric. Yes, it is true that they broke away from the old tribalism to create these civilizations and have norms that apply to everyone inside China or Persia. That's true. But they didn't go beyond that. They still remain very ethnocentric. And in my view, they never really developed universal concepts. I have a whole chapter on that as well, that a big debate. Did China come up with universal concepts? And I argue, no, that it did not. We don't need to get into that now. But I just wanted to make that point that the Axial Age, the fundamental error is that it simply refuses to recognize that period identified as the Axial Age was just the beginning of European reflectiveness and historical consciousness and universalism.
Yeah, and it's interesting how you talk about how this has developed following the Second World War, because the mass assumption with the Second World War comes from the idea that, oh, well, it was ethnocentric European countries going to war with one another, particularly Germany with the ultimate evil of Nazism, presenting the ultimate evil of nationalism, nationalism taken to its furthest extent. But the funny thing is, when you examine the history of National Socialism, it is in itself a post-Enlightenment rationalistic worldview that, whilst yes, is German supremacist, also has a, let's not say universalist, but it does have a sort of like larger abstract identity that you can lay on top of it, that being the kind of idea of the Aryan identity. So even in that way, you read about the countries that it was occupying, even in the Slavic countries, the Germans were trying to find the Nordic phenotypes, the Aryan types, as they were conceptualizing them, and trying to kind of Germanize them and in a way kind of bring them into the fold in a kind of civic manner, which is quite interesting and somewhat contradictory of this view, this very black and white view of the Second World War, without, of course, excusing anything that the National Socialists did. But with returning to the Axial Age, again, you, like the point that you're making as well is that from about 200 BC, the end point of what these scholars identify as the Axial Age, these other societies, these other civilizations and cultures, they reach a point of stasis where they kind of just get stuck where they are. China in particular is an excellent example, with Confucianism has been developed. And then even because one of the things that you're doing throughout this book is a textual analysis of the other scholarly sources, the history books, the textbooks, the philosophical discussions on these things. Even mainstream scholars, when they're coming at it from a more universalist, egalitarian, multicultural, modern perspective, there always comes a point where they have to acknowledge, yeah, everything after Confucianism in China is essentially just a play, a variation on a theme. Nothing can drift too far from Confucianism. And I just wonder, this is just a question on the top of my head right now, do you see this kind of stasis as being something that, if there hadn't been contact, greater contact, like we see with European society from about maybe the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries onwards, do you consider that these civilizations, these cultures, may have just stayed perpetually in that stasis? Because obviously you can say now, well, China has changed, but it's changed due to the communist revolution, the cultural revolution, which is itself a Western import to them.
Yes, I think people don't realize how exceptional the Greek breakthrough was and subsequent breakthroughs, because it's important to understand that just because something originates somewhere, in the case of the Greeks, it was a major breakthrough, but they were themselves preceded by the Indo-European aristocratic culture, where you see already elements of individualism. And the Indo-Europeans themselves were quite dynamic and creative. They shook the old world with their expansion and spreading out of Indo-European languages, which are now the most spoken languages in the world. But after the Greeks, then you have the Romans, and then you have the Middle Ages. So there is this continuous series of epochs in the West. But I just missed exactly what was your question about. It was it China that...
I was wondering your thoughts on these countries after they had reached the stasis at the end of their own cultural development, at the end of the Axial Age. Had it not been for greater European concept and the introduction of European concepts, would they have stayed in place?
And it's a question I think a lot about, because it's a really interesting question. Even China, the Chinese, I don't think that they too would have industrialized. There are some people that say, oh, there were signs of a steam engine, but I just don't see the signs. I don't see the Newtonian science that would have. Now, it is true, the steam engine was more of a practical instrument, and the degree to which modern science came into it is disputed, but some people say not too much, but let's say not even barely anything. You're not going to get the subsequent changes in industrial economies of the West, or what some people call the second industrial revolution that starts 1850, 1870, which is associated with electricity, chemistry, and so on, and then eventually nuclear power. You're not going to get that without science. And China had no science whatsoever of modern Newtonian science, Galilean science at all. In fact, science had a flat Earth view right up until the Europeans taught them otherwise. They believed the Earth was flat. So, I think I, at some point I posed that question in the book. Here is a civilization. It's been around thousands of years, and it is still holding this flat Earth view. So what makes you think they would on their own have eventually developed another view? Another point is, and even people that praise the intellectual achievements of China, when you read carefully to what they're saying, like this guy, I have the, yeah, here is the book. Like, you know, this guy, he loves China, and I go through it, and he tries to show, and in another book I have of him as well, he wants to show that, you know, China was really dynamic intellectually. But then if you keep reading, you realize actually he himself says that whatever came after Confucian were just variations of Confucianism, through bit of mixtures with Taoism and other schools, the Mohist and so on. They just did different combinations. And then something that happened a lot in China, you see it in painting and other cultural endeavors, that so they say they developed a particular style, variation on the style of painting, or variation on the style of thinking about Confucianism. Then a new generation comes and they are noble and new because they say, oh, I'm going to go back to this century. And I think they got it right. So they revive a type of Confucianism that existed a few centuries before. And then that becomes the new Confucianism of the Ming era, stuff like that. So that's what you see in China. You don't have this incredible variety of thinkers like Descartes and then Pascal and Spinoza and Leibniz and then Kant and then Hegel and then Nietzsche and then Heidegger. And even in the Middle Ages, it's not a complete homogeneous consensus. There's a lot of debate and thinking as to the nature of God and the nature of many things in Paris. In the high Middle Ages, there was a lot of intellectual vitality, speaking of which, universities were invented by Europeans, not in China and not by the Muslims either. And they're a reflection as well of this continuing emphasis on creating an atmosphere, an institution whereby human beings can pursue knowledge free from any other constraint or any other obligation. In the Middle Ages, yes, you were not really allowed to challenge the fundamentals of Christianity, but there was a lot of room for debate as to how you interpret Christianity and what is the place of philosophy in a society that has a strong faith foundation. There were a lot of debates about that. And eventually, yes, people begin to question Christianity itself. And once you move past the Middle Ages and you're getting into the Renaissance, it's not just a rediscovery of the achievements of the Greeks. There is also a lot of novelties in perspective painting. There is new developments in mathematics, in architecture, and then they discovered the world. The discovery of the world and the mapping of the world, again, is not a simple thing. China...
So many people would, a lot of people who are on the political left would find it very contentious that you're saying the discovery of the world. We hear this all the time now. Nobody discovered America because there were already people there. So when you say discovery of the world and the mapping out of the world, what do you mean?
Well, and I have said this at X, and people get upset or they think it's funny, but I say things like the Africans did not even know where they were, and neither the Amerindians in Amerindia. Of course, they knew the immediate surrounding environment, and they knew it very well. They had to live in a very close relationship with nature. They knew it a lot better than we do. We live in this environment today. We're not trying to make a living from the nature that's out there anymore. But so what I mean when I say discover is that you have a globalizing perspective. You can see the entirety of the earth. And one of the greatest achievements of Europeans was the mapping of the world. It's not just the discovery, it's the associated mapping of the world as they're discovering the world. The Portuguese did that right away when nobody knew where Africa ended. And the Portuguese, in a very conscious, programmatic way, said, we got to get down to the tip of Africa because somehow, somewhere that has to end, and then we might be able to move into the Indian Ocean and get access to the spice trade. And so they developed a scientific center and began a slow navigation down the West African coast. And it took them decades and decades. And finally, by the end of the 1400s, 1492 or something, they hit the tip and then they began to move. And this was a scientific exploration. They began mapping all those coastlines. And you can see the map of them mapping it to know, because they would come back and they want to tell the other people that are coming back, look, this is how far we got and this is what you're going to see. So that started with the Portuguese. Then once Columbus moved, you know, they like to say, oh, Columbus stumbled into the Americas to his deathbed. He said he was just near China and so on. It doesn't matter. The point is that right after Columbus, you see one discoverer after another moving on. And this is something that is important to understand about the West. In China, you see someone that kind of invents a printing mechanical press, but they barely improve upon it. The compass is the same, barely improved upon. Whereas the Europeans did observe, they had curiosity about what other people had achieved, and then they began to tinker and improve those things in a continuous basis. So the mapping of the world is very important because it's what really gives you a sense of where you are relative to other people. So when I say they discovered the Americas, they realized that the Americas was a whole new continent eventually. And not only that, that there were these two big land masses, in North America and then South America. And then Magellan circumnavigated the entirety of the earth. Yes, he died at some point, and then somebody else, the second guy in command, finished the trip. But they circumnavigated the whole of the earth. This had never been done before, and to me, that's what it means to have a true cosmopolitan earthly view and to know where you're located. And we take that for granted. We see a globe like the one I have right here beside me and think that that's normal. No, nobody knew where they were. Nobody knew the shape of the earth. The maps that China had created, and they were the best maps at the time. In ancient times, the Chinese had very good grids and all the things to make things, the spatial correlations, accurate distance and so on. But it was just about China. And then what they put around it is just very vague lines. There's nothing there. They never cared to move into the Pacific. When the Chinese navigated with those huge ships with Cheng He or Cheng Ho in the 1420s, 1430s, it was really a diplomatic mission through areas of the sea and the ocean that had been traveled many times before. They didn't discover anything. The Portuguese discovered a lot more. And as I said, then the Spaniards came, and then the Italians, and then the French, and then the English, and it was one after another. And so the discovery of the world to me is a very crucial thing. And to go back then to that question, I sometimes think there could well be planets in the universe where modernity never arrives. That can happen. We should not presume that the moment you have humans, you automatically are going to get even rational beings. Because even becoming conscious that you have a mind itself didn't happen anywhere else. And you need to become conscious that you have this faculty, and that faculty is the only faculty you have that allows you to make truth claims, to verify, validate, and engage with others. And so even that didn't happen all across the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting when you point to that book on Chinese history, how they're trying to almost superimpose the achievements of Western civilization onto other cultures as well. Because I don't think these people realize they're doing it, because it's like the fish that swims in water doesn't realize that it's in water or what water is, that they are in fact actually trying to Europeanize those other cultures in the first place by applying their own standards. It's the same way that we, through the global perspective that you're taking on, that we've taken on, and the globalization of the world, the only reason that these foreign cultures and civilizations even care about these things or even want to lay claim to them is because their own standards of minds have been so thoroughly westernized on the global stage that they feel inadequate as a result. But they're actually, you know, from an ancient Chinese perspective, surely that solidarity, that ability to remain steady and stay in place against the winds of change would potentially historically have been seen as a positive virtue. Whereas in the West, the idea of development and continual change has been the virtue. They're diametrically opposed to one another. So it's interesting that we feel the need to try and show that, no, China was doing exactly what we were doing and even better, when to an ancient Chinese perspective, that would be a horrifying thing.
Yes, the Western academics play it both ways. And there's a chapter there on the Chinese mentality that I address this. There is a school that says that China had its own enlightenment. It reached its own universal values in law, in morality, in the conceptualization of the world, in their science. Then there is another school that says, no, actually, you know, China was more profound than the West because it could see the limitations of this rationalistic view of the world. They had a more pragmatic, hermeneutic conception of the world, whereby they knew that all things should be contextualized. So my argument is that both those schools are fundamentally wrong. The Chinese were contextualized in an unconscious way. They did not know how to transcend their time and their context. Therefore, their thinking remained contextualized. When Europeans began to contextualize their thinking, they did so because they had experienced this differentiation of the I from the rest of the non-I. And only then could they contextualize things and see the limitations of reason. Because I'm not the kind of person that believes that the scientific rational view is the way to absolute truth and is the only way to knowledge and is the culmination of all things. I think many critics, Schopenhauer, Heidegger, Nietzsche, and so on, make incredibly valuable points. In the case of Nietzsche, for example, I think he is correct that reason per se is not going to give you access to many things that are important in life and that shape us as human beings. That's not a very good explanation, but one way to put it is this way, that it's not that Nietzsche denies reasoning, is that he rejects the notion that reasoning needs to be based on a rationalistic foundation for it to be proper reasoning. So you can engage in reasoning like even Carl Jung did. If you examine his books and the way his ideas developed, there is a lot of reasoning going there, but he doesn't have a rationalistic foundation to get into the archetypes. He uses another way of reasoning, of thinking, that recognizes the mythological, the dream side of human beings, and that knows that many things in our minds still carry things from the past that were pre-rational. We still carry that within us.
This is a kind of intuitive thinking rather than purely rationalistic.
Yes. So anyway, that's another, I guess, another line of thinking, but.
Just to return to the thought that I was pursuing a moment ago. What I was discussing was kind of like the way that, for instance, Egyptians who, when we got there, had treasures that had been buried for hundreds or even thousands of years and didn't care about them until we got there, and then we attach value to them. And because they have been westernized, or perhaps if you want to be more cynical, because they want to take advantage of our way of thinking for their own gain, we've got some of their artifacts, we've got mummies, we've got sarcophagi in their in our museums, and they say, no, you stole that from us, and we want that back because it's part of our national heritage. Well, you didn't actually conceptualize it as your national heritage, or as having any value at all. It was just buried in the dirt until we got there. So it's interesting to question, is it just cynicism, or have they already been so westernized in our own image? We've been so successful at colonizing, globalizing, and westernizing these places that they suddenly do have more of a value system that's closer to ours than it would be their own ancestors.
Yes, one of the amazing differences between the West and the rest is that the West developed a historical consciousness. When you examine the major contenders on the rise of the West or the Great Divergence, what makes the West different, their focus is on why did the West industrialize first and then modern science, and they restrict themselves to that. Really, they don't see much and they don't want to see much. I have debates with a lot of these people, and they kind of sense I'm saying something that, yeah, it makes sense, but they don't want to go there, and they get afraid and they pull back and they say, how could you possibly say they didn't have a historical consciousness? And I say things like, well, find me a book written by an Indian that has a sense of time and is dedicated to hi through historical inquiry, documentation, developing a proper method by so that you're able to go back to the past and know what really transpired in
And
the past.
critically analyzing the documentation and the sort of
Yes.
reports that we have from people, eyewitnesses and such.
Yes, and develop eventually a periodization. This is unique to Europeans. All the periodizations we have in history are all, when we talk about, simply ancient and Middle Ages and modern, and then there are many other more specific periodizations, but also in geology, in biology, in the way we periodize the history of the universe, their names. The first 3 seconds have a name, the next one have a name. All that is done by the Europeans. That's part of a sense of history, of historical consciousness. That's why I always say you cannot understand anything that happened in Europe unless you have a historical consciousness yourself. You approach everything from a historical perspective. So when somebody asks you, what is capitalism? What is liberalism? You must always be aware that those things have a history. They unfolded and developed in time, and their meaning changes through time. So you cannot pick and say, this is something like Paul Gottfried, for example, when he talks about liberalism, he says, oh, liberalism is what classical liberalism was, and many others do that, and that's the true liberalism. That's what I want, and that's where I'm going back to. Well, no, that's the liberalism of a particular time in a place in Western history that is no longer exists, and that we're now in another type of liberalism. So you have to do that with everything that happens in the West. If you study painting, what you see in the Renaissance, it's not the painting of the West. It's just a moment in the history
So,
of
so, so
painting.
you're, so you're taking a kind of historicist approach to your
Yes,
thinking with this.
I have a chapter there where I do embrace a historicist perspective of things that, in regards to understanding what happened in the West, it's very important to embrace that. But you said something else that I wanted to address. I can.
Was it about the potential westernization of other cultures?
Yes, that we take it for granted, right? That we take it for granted that the Chinese today and Egypt, that's what I want to get about, that we the Egyptians, that's right, they didn't have a historical consciousness. they knew those pyramids and that there were burials there and things there that had happened back way in time. But they didn't have the curiosity, the sense of let's investigate that. They didn't even know how to investigate that. What do you do if you look at that? You can't trace it here. So Europeans developed archaeology. And then they developed a method by which they could establish with incredible precision how old is that. And that requires chemistry and geology to be able to date things that are from a long time ago. So now they can date anything. It's amazing. They date everything. And that's part of the historical consciousness. So they didn't have an archaeological mind. I have a chapter, I think it's six, in which is about the development of all these disciplines, geology, chemistry, cartography, and other disciplines. Europeans develop all the disciplines of knowledge. And so these people here who are, you know, they're big stars in academia, you know, he has a theory of why Europe industrialized first. And I'm like, you know, that's just the Industrial Revolution. And they're industrializing now. In a way, they're saying, oh, yeah, now China is surpassing it. And Europe, you know, achieved its own thing for a few centuries. But now they're being displaced and surpassed. And China is far more advanced industrially. Because they missed so many other things, that all these disciplines of knowledge, yes, there was religious thinking among the Zoroastrians, there were religious texts, and among the Muslims, there is a theology going on, but never to the degree to which you see it among Catholics in medieval Europe. So, and also before the Muslims, it was the Greeks in Byzantium who transformed Christianity into a theology because they integrated with Greek philosophy. So they developed that too. They developed history, chemistry, botany, biology, astronomy, geometry. I mean, it goes on. So that has to be explained. And you can't do it through the Jared Diamond way, because Jared Diamond, he does make some good points. I do think that if you are the Eskimos, you're going to have a hard time modernizing. If you are in Africa too, because there were not that many animals to domesticate, very, very few, if any, to domesticate. So that puts you at a disadvantage. And the climate too was made it more difficult. I don't deny these other explanations. They're always part of the dynamic, but you have to focus on that which makes the difference and that which allows for all of this coming of new disciplinary fields of knowledge. So it doesn't come directly from environmental conditions. These things are, you know, the debate on what makes the West different is being constrained, delimited, as we get more multicultural and our classrooms become more diverse. It's almost as if you're prohibited from understanding your own history. Because if you do, you will realize these things and you're not supposed to.
And of course, you mentioned Joseph Heinrich and his work on the weirdness, as he deems it, of Europe and Western people. Even in a situation where it's somebody like Joseph Heinrich who is acknowledging what separates us from the rest of the world, he's still framing it in the perspective of it was all an accident. The Catholic Church just decided on a whim because of a random interpretation of theology to ban cousin marriage, which just happened to accidentally promote conditions that would end up leading to a liberalized secular West that ends up modernizing and creating the Industrial Revolution. Whereas you put forward the argument that no, this was not an accident. The Europeans were not just accidentally stumbling through history, developing all of the major fields of the academy. They weren't just stumbling through history like they make the argument with Columbus, where he just accidentally stumbled across America and discovers the rest of the world. That this was intentional. To a large degree, most of these developments were a conscious thing that Europeans were pursuing. And I do find it unfortunate that even when people acknowledge like you, the book is called Greatness and Ruin, even when they acknowledge the greatness of European civilization, they still have to pull it down so that other peoples, on the standards that we set for them, won't feel bad.
Yes, Joseph Henrich, yes, that's one of the major flaws, and it's not a small flaw, is that in his view, the Catholic Church decided to impose monogamy and prohibit polygamy, which he says encouraged Europeans to develop civic associations and institutions, because in the past, the kinship network was itself the institutional framework within which you acted. But once the big polygamous networks are eliminated and you have smaller monogamous families, they have to decide, how do we connect with each other since we no longer belong to these kinship networks? They're being prohibited. Of course, ethnocentrism remains, extended families remain for a while, you know, nothing happens overnight. But slowly and gradually, Europeans, in his view, began to develop civic associations whereby you allow strangers to become part of it, not just members of your tribe, strangers, and then you develop rules that apply to all of them, regardless of where they came from. And the university is a case in point. The university is a corporate institution that is free from any kinship group, is free from any monarchy per se, and is kind of autonomous and self-contained, and it has its own rules. And students from all parts of Europe could go to a university in Bologna or in Paris. They would come and they were allowed in. That wouldn't happen in other societies, and there were other factors that made it different. So this happened in Europe, and Joseph Henry just comes up with this weird, speaking of weird, he calls it weirdest people, but it's kind of a weird explanation where he says, you know, they abolished polygamy because they were uptight about sex. They didn't like people having so much sex or men having so many wives, stuff like that. And I'm like, well, first of all, and this is something that Kevin McDonald, by the way, did the research on this, monogamy already was already there among the pre-Catholic peoples. It wasn't completely to the degree to which the Catholic Church wanted it, and very wealthy, powerful men still were polygamous, but there was a monogamous atmosphere because of the nature of the climate. You couldn't really extend many wives, and people tended to disperse more because a particular land could not sustain extended kinship groups,
so they spread out. McDonald in Individualism in the Western Tradition is also argues that because of that difficulty of the climate, you end up having to develop trade networks based on reputation, which ends up developing this kind of more disconnected community where people are able to better view themselves as smaller kinship networks, which can eventually develop into individuals, because, like you say, you can't actually survive is this huge family on so few resources, and then you end up having smaller monogamous families with fewer children where you put more resources into those individual children, as opposed to, say, I think this is R versus K selection in the sort of like, Rushton in his conception, whereas Africans have, I think it's the R selection, where because there is an abundance in the environment around them, they can have children and not really look after them. The fathers can go from one woman to a next, impregnating them. And there is enough abundance in the environment around them to be able to sustain them.
Yes, and I think that's those kinds of explanations have to be integrated into what Joseph Henrich is arguing. The other thing is, and where I try to add another angle, is that the Romans and the Greeks also practiced monogamy to some degree. Now, they were not living in cold climates or anything like that. So to me, this is part of the higher degree of consciousness that they had away from tribalism. and creating a civic identity. And they felt that with polygamous families, you're going to get these aristocratic clans with leaders continuously bickering with each other. So that had to be broken up, create a civic identity, and then that's sustained through monogamous relationships. And so to me, this was a conscious decision. And then the Catholic Church understood that, and Christianity itself opposed polygamy, opposed marriage among cousins, and for moral reasons, but also because they knew it harmed, from their perspective, it was not the proper way to raise children. In other words, if you have multiple wives, the children start competing with each other as to who's going to get the inheritance, and there were vicious civil wars within the extended families, and they understood that and thought about it. It's not like suddenly out of nowhere they were uptight about the sexual habits of polygamous men. It's not that. But Joseph Embridge, you know, his work, I spent a lot of time on it because it is a great piece of work. But he's a typical liberal. No sooner was his book published, he wrote an article, which I mentioned, saying that immigration is great and beautiful. Anyway, I'm not going to get into that now, but he inhabits an academic world in which, yes, you're not allowed, whites are not allowed to celebrate their history. You can condemn it, talk about the dark past, and trans say, oh, but we abolished slavery. They let you do that. Like, okay, you became good later. That's good for you. You did something good. So that's what some of the conservatives do. They want to be good people, and they say the good things they did after all the nasty stuff. Oh, we decolonized, you know. Yes, okay, we colonized you, but we became good people. Now, they're never going to forgive you. On the contrary, if you give them a bit of rope, they're going to grab more and more because they're sensing these people are weak. They're for the taking. So, yeah, he inhabits that world. I realize, you know, when I left the left, and I realized that you cannot really arrive at the truth with that mindset. That Nietzsche was right about many things, that knowledge, there's an element of struggle, there is power involved here, there is character. You have to have character to be able to just say it outright. I mean, when I would go to conference in Canada and I started saying things about what the West achieved, they go crazy shouting, like, you know, it was like a commotion.
Well,
how dare you?
I mean, on this subject then, so the book is called Greatness and Ruin, and I think we've been talking a lot about the greatness of Western civilization up until this point. Let's talk about the ruin that it could be leading us into, the sort of like logical endpoint of this abstract, individualistic, egalitarian strain of thought, which, as we have been discussing, was kind of developing throughout those 2,000 plus years from when from the Greek discovery of the self. We've already mentioned how in the discovery of the world and maps and map creation itself, like, you start to globalize your own thinking and you discover these other people. And yes, back then you have slightly like more ethnocentric views of your own community. You see things in a more divisive, conflict way when you're in America and you're having to fight off these tribes. But now we've got to the point where the strain of thought has come to inviting these people in with modern liberalism. Like, just to give it my own example, I mean, you talk about music in this and you talk about the different epochs of classical music, which you can't really easily hand over to foreign cultures. Classical music is one of those things that is so uniquely European and so tied into European patronage and aristocratic culture that it can't really be easily handed over to foreign cultures. But I, playing rock and heavy metal music, have heard it my entire life that the only reason that white people play rock music is because they stole it off of black people. Chuck Berry was the first person to ever play an electric guitar, and then white people like Elvis heard that and they needed to steal it, despite the fact, of course, that you can make the argument, as I have done many times, that the music, the instruments they were playing were all made in Europe. The scales that they were playing, the diatonic scales, were all developed in Europe. The formations of the groups that they were playing in, that being a drummer, bassist, guitarist, vocalist, is basically a European folk in folk band formation. So there are all of these different things, but no, because of the fact that there's a tweet that goes around, you may have seen sometimes, where they say, oh, you know, Led Zeppelin were great, but they'd have been nothing if old Jigaboo Jackson hadn't put a string on a stick one time in the 1930s. And as well as that, you know, I sorry to go on a little bit of a tangent here with the music, like the blues scale, which is basically just an adapted, like a chromatic pentatonic scale. They pretend like Africans invented the pentatonic scale, despite the fact even within European classical music, the composers would from time to time use the pentatonic scale because it's just a five-note scale. This weird idea that diminishing Europeans means insinuating that by themselves, Europeans would never have figured out to take two notes out of the minor scale. It's
it's absurd, yes. I happen to be writing a few posts about classical musical instruments. And I just say a little bit as to when they were invented and the kinds of changes that were introduced into them to make them better, and how composers themselves would instigate changes because their musical minds would say this is not good enough. And the instrument makers, who were themselves musicians and understood music, new, you got to improve this in the piano in order to make the music come out. So one of the things that surprises me is that, yes, I mean, the book that I'm happy to be reading is quite good in the sense that it doesn't say, oh, there were these precedents, you know, like we had a guy with a stick and a few strings. They don't even consider that. They understand that these musical instruments, most of the musical instruments you see in the world really came into their own as proper musical instruments during the starting in the Renaissance, really in the Baroque period, and later, even in the 1800s, they were still refining them, making them the sound come to its fullest, because musicians were inspiring these changes. They would compose, and then another composer comes up and is envisioning other sounds and things. So, it's a kind of dialectic that is going on here that is just simply absent outside. Almost all musical instruments were invented by white, including rock and roll. Is really a white thing. It's a part of the peculiar white spirit of rebelliousness and individualism, and kind of just transcending what's around you or longing for something that's not here and doesn't exist.
Well, when we talk about the individualism, a lot of the kind of developments that we're discussing are really like individual white men deciding they want to be better than the next guy over. They know what the best guy is. They want to be better than that. And as an electric guitarist who plays solo lead guitar for the songs that I write, I can see that tracing even up to this day. You still see on the internet all sorts of people playing the instrument. And the guitar has been around for a long time, but you still see developments made to the electric guitar now. Add strings, subtract strings, you add this trinket to it, you add this to it, so that we can make new sounds and approach the instrument in a whole new way. Rock music can't just be a variation of what was done in the 1960s, because then you're derivative, so you have to be doing new things. You can't be as good as the guitarists were in the 80s, because that's just not good enough anymore. It's this constant striving and striving and striving. I know you have a part of a Marxist background, and you've mentioned capitalism there. And I wonder your thoughts on the role of modern capitalism mixed with this. You've mentioned your historicist perspective, modern liberalism, how those two are completely intertwined together. So in recent developments, just this past weekend when we're recording this, America has gone to war with Iran. And one of the things that we see, one of the justifications that we see for the reason that we need to be bombing Iran. We need to be bombing their schools, going to war in the Middle East again. This time we swear it'll be different. Is that you have this large chunk of supposedly Iranian diaspora women on social media posting about how, well, in Iran, I would have had to cover my tits up. And I don't want to have to do that. I want to be able to get my OnlyFans started, and I want to be an independent woman. So I wonder how much of this modern liberalism, this development that we've taken down, obviously is different, as you mentioned, from the classical Lockean liberalism, and is even to a certain extent different from the Millsian liberalism of on utility, and is actually a development of essentially PR firms in capitalist corporations pushed by the kind of PR thinking and propaganda of Edward Bernays, this opening up of the worldwide market so that everything is consumable, everything has a price and a monetary value attached to it. I wonder your thoughts on that part of capitalism mixed with modern liberalism and how connected the two are.
I think coming from my Marxist background, this is something that you can see it in my book, Canada in Decay, that I start writing about the role of capitalism in pushing through multiculturalism in Canada, something that would be beneficiary to the economy. But I've gone beyond that and gone deeper into trying to understand first that liberalism in the West emerged in close alignment and association with capitalism. They really get along with each other. And you can't separate them in the West. In China, they decided to go with capitalism, but not liberalism. So they have an authoritarian form of capitalism. And that's very different. And even in Japan, you don't have the liberal capitalism that you have in the West, even though you have formal liberal institutions. The Chinese psychologically are not a liberal people. But that capitalism carries elements of liberalism within it, even when it is authoritarian, because of the fluidity of markets, the movements of peoples looking online, and the comfort of consumerism and all the rest. But in the West, they came very tightly together, and they're still tightly together, and you cannot understand liberalism as it exists today is in a woke form. That's the latest version of liberalism. It's not a new ideology. It's not cultural Marxism. It's not communism. When Americans keep saying, oh, we are ruled by communists, they don't understand. Communism collapsed. It only exists in North Korea and poor Cuba. But so what we have is woke liberalism, and capitalism is aligned with it.
Well, I suggested for a few years now that you invite all of these people in off of the back of their ability to raise GDP, the benefits that they bring to broadening the consumer class and for depressing wages. You know, they very useful for breaking up unions and such. They're brought in, but then being displaced. These are a tribal people. These are people who do not think in the sort of Western ways in which we've been discussing the whole time. They're displaced, and this causes a lot of problems. They look around at the world that they now inhabit, and they don't recognize it, and they see nothing that attaches them to this place. And so I saw wokeness as an ideology offshoot development of liberalism as a way of creating like a fully inclusive, intersectional ideology that would accept and integrate all of these foreign peoples who've been brought in without asking them to change much. They're not the ones that are asked to change. We, the ones who are most susceptible to this kind of subversion, are the ones who are told, you just need to accept that your history is their history now, your achievements were their achievements all along.
The thing with capitalism is that one has to understand that it is not interested in ethnic cultural identities. They view you as an individual consumer, and they measure you and judge you in terms of your market activities. So any person from anywhere in the world is as good as anyone else, as long as they are participants in that market network. When people at X, just to because we don't have much time. When people at X, for example, point images, videos of how England looked in the 30s, 40s, 60s, and it all looks so pleasant and, you know, it was clean and people had an identity and they were all white. One of the things I think is capitalism doesn't want that anymore. That's not a world that would allow it to maximize itself. It much rather prefers the chaos that you see in London today. It much rather prefers the intermixing of peoples. It doesn't want to see cute families with father, mother, and children carefully allocating their resources and spending and so on. No, it wants a chaos, a dissolution, ruthless peoples continuously consuming. And now capitalism is no longer into a stage of just production. We know that it moved into the service sector, but it has gone beyond the service sector into what I call limbic capitalism, which is a type of capitalism whereby it directly goes into that part of your brain that can make you addictive. The way you become addicted to drugs, to pornography, to social online, to X, scrolling all day long, to seeing views, to going to all fans. What is that? Fans were
what? Only fans, the online pornography site, which basically advertises itself as your 18-year-old daughter, the second she hits her 18th birthday, can go online and become a become a whore.
Right. That's limbic capitalism. It wants that type of person. They don't want a daughter that's carefully spending her income and wears a dress and is not shopping that much. They want one that's constantly buying, shopping, has emotional instability, needs this little drug here and that little entertainment and that little thing and there, and it's continuously in a state of consumption. I think that it prefers that. It is a complicated discussion that, you know, we would have to develop it slowly, step by step, to clearly understand why it is that capitalism, as I think I'm beginning to believe, loves this multi-rational, slightly chaotic world that we're witnessing across all the major cities of the West. So people say, oh, well, but that's not the case in China or Japan. No, it's not, because they don't have the liberal side. So you have to see the two in combination. And liberalism has its own roles. And sometimes what liberalism calls for is something that contradicts what capitalism wants. So, for example, when liberalism persists, we need more affirmative action. We need that black guy to be leading the space program or leading this new technology and engineering. You know, some capitalist business, I'm going to say, hold on here. You know, we either produce that product and we need people with the most talent and best education to get it out, or we're not going to do it with that. But it finds ways, because in the service sector, you can integrate all kinds of people. In universities, you have so many programs that are just very average. You don't really need to. Most PhDs.
With the development of AI, you can hire countless Indians who don't know how to code, right, but just use AI to do it.
Exactly, yes. So I think we have to think about that. And it puts me in a dilemma, because I'm not a communist. And yes, we are all to some degree socialistic. I think in one way or another, we kind of agree that maybe public schools were all right and you need public transportation and that kind of thing. But I understand that capitalism is a very rational, efficient system for the allocation of scarce resources, and it is unbeatable. That's why the Chinese adopted it. They know you can't compete with a society unless you have markets.
Well, that's been a really, really interesting discussion. I have really found a lot to think about. I hope the audience has found a lot to think about. Just one last thing. Do you, a big question, but let's try and Let's try and sum it all up. Do you think that there is hope for the European peoples and the West going forward, or are we caught in a downward spiral?
We are not getting out through a peaceful, legitimate party process. We're not getting out of this. The reason Trump back off in Minnesota, he came a little bit hard, but back off is because the system, the woke system, came in and really stopped him. And I think he knows he cannot deport the millions he seemed to imply he was going to deport. I don't know what the numbers are. So maybe what, 1 million, 1.5 self-deported, although these are numbers people throw out without really knowing.
I think the number that I saw was, I think, 2 million. I spoke to Cyan from the White Papers Policy Institute recently. She'd be able to cite the numbers. I know that last year it was reported that more people self-deported than came into the country for the first time in decades are the figures that the government and some of its associated think tanks were throwing out.
Yes. But he himself, in terms of deporting people directly, is no more than 200,000, is it?
I don't know the exact numbers.
Yeah, but it's nowhere near the big numbers people expected. And in a sense, just think him trying to do that, trying to actually deport the illegals who now have jobs and have children, dragging them out. He can say, I'm going to deport the criminals, and that's what he did, just the ones who committed crimes. But even if they're illegal, but now they have a job, he's not going to deport them. So the reason for that is that the constitutional order almost basically prohibits you from doing that because that person has rights. And the same thing is, now think of the legal immigrants in England. There are millions of them. How can you think of a party grabbing citizens? And if you're a citizen, you're as much British as somebody who has ancestry there for generations, because that's what the Constitution says. All the laws say that. So,
well, it is a bit different in Britain because our Constitution is more informal than in America, and we have parliamentary sovereignty. So, for instance, in Britain, we've just had a party startup that we're all very supportive of called Restore, headed by Rupert Lowe, which does seem to be articulating these kinds of ideas that we do need to return to a British Britain. One of the guys who's associated with them, who's associated with us, Charlie Downs, has explicitly said that having the passport does not necessarily make you British. So we're excited about them for the sorts of points that they're pushing. And with a system like Britain with parliamentary sovereignty, if you have a majority within Parliament and they all vote for a bit of legislation, if, for instance, tomorrow a piece of legislation was put through Parliament that said, if it was literally an ethno-nationalist law that said you have to be white with Anglo-Saxon ancestry to be considered British, and if you're not, we will deport you. If they all voted on it with a parliamentary majority, that would be law and it would override the pieces of legislation that came before. You could also vote to repeal on all of these different laws that have been put in place previously as well. So there is a bit of a difference with the British system, but I do understand that it's easy enough to pass those laws, but then when it comes to the practical reality of implementing them, this is something I said the other day, like liberalism, modern capitalistic liberalism, kind of dirties you and gets you to buy in by, you can't deport all of these people. My sister is married to a foreigner. My best friend is a foreigner. You can't ban pornography. I watch it. You can't get rid of Chinese takeaways. I love eating Chinese takeaway. There are all of these different little ways to dirty yourself so you feel personally invested in the system as it currently exists right now, because we all are, to a certain extent, individualistic consumers.
Well, that's a good thing to hear about the parliamentary autonomy in that regard. But either way, we're not getting out. Even if, let's say, we get the what are they called? Restore Britain?
The new Restore Britain is the party here, yes.
Yeah, let's say that they become the majority in 10 years and they get elected. And they go about it. It's not going to happen peacefully. They created a really nasty situation that, so my, what I want to get to is this point, that my hope is that we are getting out of this, except an incredibly difficult quasi-civil-like situation. And my other hope is that I do think liberalism has reached a dead end, that it no longer carries the persuasive power it did, that people are beginning to see that it has reached a point that it is an irrational ideology. It's also totalitarian, that seeks to control how people think. So it has abandoned it, that mill view of liberty. It is at a stage at which it wants to shape and control you, so you become internally a woke person, and that there is reaction, and there is going to be a reaction against that, and for a whole host of other reasons, racial tensions and so on, the system is going to disintegrate ever more into chaotic zones here and there, even though the technology and the innovations go on. So that's where the opening lies for me. It's not going to be a peaceful, calm thing. And history has always been that way. All the revolutions were bloody revolutions, including the Glorious War. I mean, by the standards of the Civil War, the Glorious War was peaceful, but it was preceded by a really nasty civil war in the 1640s. And the same thing with the French Revolution and the Bolshevik Revolution and all of them. They're always messy affairs. And this is the most radical transformation that they have imposed on the West. And getting out of it has going to be the most radical overcoming that we have ever seen around, because we have millions of aliens in our lands. And as you just said, you know, they're the friends of many people. You're married to them. That's why they promote race mixing so incessantly. They know race mixing is the final solution. Once you race mix them, it's finished. So that's why ads keep insisting on this. So yeah, it's gonna be a lot of stuff happening.
Well, on that cheery note, thank you very much for joining us. I hope you found this discussion enlightening and revealing at home. And I hope that you take the time to go out and purchase a copy of Dr. Ricardo Duchesne's book, Greatness and Ruin. I really got a lot out of this. And even though it's a massive tome, it really was an engaging read all the way through. You will get a lot of value out of this. So please support Dr. Duchesne. Thank you again for joining us for this discussion today. Is there anything you'd like to say? Where can people find you?
Yes, well, I'm at X. You can find me there. I just noted if I should, I don't know if I should say, but Musk reposted something I posted. So anyway, I'm in X, at X, and that's where I am. That's where you can find me. And I have a link to the book there. I used to have a blog, but I stopped it. I had it for 11 years or more than that. Yeah. That's all I can say. Yeah. And it was a great discussion, and yes, good talking to you.
Thank you very much. Well, we'll see you next time, folks, and take care.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on two purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.